Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the show, we're going to be talking to Camille Flores about the book Santa Fe Icons, 50 Symbols of the City Different, and we're going to be talking about the renovation of the San Miguel Chapel with the folks from Cornerstones and St. Michael's High School. I'm very happy now to welcome David Grant Noble. He's a photographer and writer, and his new book is called In the Places of the Spirits, and it's published by the School for Advanced Research Press. He will be speaking this coming Thursday, the 22nd of July, at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening, and then he will be at Bookworks in Albuquerque on Sunday, the 25th of July. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is a book which, as much as anything, is a kind of artistic document of your travels around the Southwest and your encounters with long-gone people and the ruins left behind, if you want to call them ruins, the sites left behind. How did you get into this work and this passion?
Well, Mary Charlotte, I came to Santa Fe in 1971 from New York City, and in New York, I've been photographing Mohawk steelworkers. They do the high steelwork on the skyscrapers. And so I had gotten interested in photographing Native American life, contemporary Native American life. And my wife and I had traveled across the country for 2 summers, visiting Indian country, going to reservations all across the Northeast and Canada and out west. And we ended up in Santa Fe. And the following spring, that was the spring of 1972, the School of American Research, which is what the School for Advanced Research was called then, hired me to be the record photographer on its archaeological excavations at Arroyo Hondo Pueblo, which is right near Santa Fe. And I was documenting archaeological work as it was happening, photographing floors and artifacts on a kind of minute-by-minute basis as they were exposed in the excavation process, but for scientific purposes, you know, with a meter stick. And it was purely scientific documentation, but it introduced me to the historical culture of the Southwest and also into archaeology. And I ended up working at the school for 17 years after that. And I got interested in writing a guidebook to archaeological sites in the Southwest, and that took me several years. And this was a guidebook to places and sites that are open to the public and interpreted and protected. And that was my first book, and it was also my education in Southwestern prehistory and the ancient cultures who lived here before Europeans. And that photography was not so much scientific documentation as illustrations for the book. And I began to feel as I was photographing that there was a lot of potential in photographing ancestral landscapes, I might call them, from more of an artistic or fine art viewpoint. And I began doing that and did that for many years, 35 years. The first picture in this book I made in 1976, so about 35 years ago. And so by now, I have a really large archive of this work. And all, except for a very few photographs, I never published it. I did often show it in galleries. I had used to have gallery representation in Santa Fe and other places, so these were more photographs for exhibition than for illustration. And I was kind of puzzled about how to do a text to accompany these pictures. I wanted the book to be more than a collection of pictures. So that process took place off and on over years. I did a lot of books in the interim and ended up with the format that you saw when you read this book, which is a little different from what most photography or textbooks do.
Yeah, and it actually kind of brings up an interesting question, which is, what does archaeology do best, and what does it not do? Because you're, in my view, filling in a kind of a whole area that archaeology is not involved in.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. What archaeology does best is basically scientific. It's pulling objects out of the ground that reveal tidbits about history. Archaeology in Europe comes under the Department of History, whereas here it's a social science, and it comes under anthropology. So archaeology, you know, it's like pulling pages or sentences of a book out of the ground and putting together a puzzle to reconstruct what people were like, what their behavior was, how they lived, what they did, what they ate, what their health was like, and that kind of thing. And that's not what I do. I'm interested in the history of the people, which archaeologists are, but I was interested in the experience of going to places where our ancestors, in the general sense, lived and survived and dealt with the environment, and then in many cases left the places where they lived and left ruins behind and rock art and various types of evidence of their passing. And so my take on it is more personal and artistic than it is scientific.
Yeah, very much so. And there's lots of, in the writing, there's lots of personal descriptions of things like getting stuck and waiting all day, or yeah, trying to get your car out of, or taking your nieces to a corn dance, which is supposed to bring rain, and having it then rain, and the nieces say, "Does it always happen like that?"
Yeah.
And things like that, and looking for petroglyphs all day, and they elude you, and it brings up the kinds of relationships that are, well, I mean, you titled the book In the Places of the Spirits. It's hard to talk about spirits and spiritual things like that in the context of archaeology, but you kind of give a sense of walking around almost among the ghosts and having some kinds of relationship with the past that is, what's the word I'm looking for?
Spiritual.
Yeah.
That's the way I feel when I'm exploring these ancient places, is that, I don't know if ghost is the right word, but the essence or the spirit of the people who live there still lingers. And in selecting and photographing, this is what really turned me on, is landscapes which have some evidence of human presence from the past, in which you can feel that spirit. And also exploring the way Native Americans think about landscape, which is quite different from European Americans and the tradition of being in a landscape and how we interact with it and use it. But also, in the process of photographing or doing whatever one does out in the world, you have experiences. And so part of the text of this book consists of personal narratives or memoir, passages of memoir about the experiences that I had when I was out in the field photographing. And what I saw and what I felt, the suspense of waiting for the right light, or, as you said, getting stuck in an arroyo out in a remote place and being short of water and wondering how I was going to get out of that. And another thing that I tried to explore in that part of the text was why I was drawn or compelled to make a photograph. So we all see landscape as we go along in our lives, but as a photographer, there are some places and some lights and environments that, you know, I get a feeling in my gut that there's art here, and there's a photograph to be made. And I tried to explore in the text what that was and how these photographs related to both my experience photographing the place, but where I came from in my childhood and my experiences in life, and what it was that moved me about a certain scene. There's one photograph, for example, that's of a very seldom visited cliff dwelling in Utah, a very remote place. And it's a building that's very handsome and that was abandoned and is in wonderful condition. It looks like people packed up and left last month. And it reminded me
of... How very strange it must be to be there.
Yeah, it was. And that's a good example of where you feel the presence of the past in the present. But it reminded me of a dream that I had repeatedly that I tell about in the book. And so I realized that perhaps this dream that I have, which goes into my subconscious, related to the fact that I was moved by this particular cliff dwelling.
So when you look at all these petroglyphs, and there are various theories about what these petroglyphs are, one of them being that they're shamanic visions of some kind, how do they speak to you?
I when I am experiencing rock art, I find that I'm more interested in the imagery and the effect that they have on me than in analyzing them either from a psychological standpoint or anthropological. And there are some very good books that have been written about rock art by scholars who analyze the artistic sequence and the cultural history and try to analyze the meaning of them. But I find that most of this art was done so long ago that Native American groups today often have very little contact with what it means. I mean, some of the most moving rock art in the Southwest was done during the Archaic period, which is 2,000 to 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. And, you know, that's a long time to have for Native Americans today to have some kind of continuous narrative about the meaning of it. Those people have long gone. But when you or I look at some of these images, they're deeply moving, and they strike a religious and spiritual note, and that's universal. It doesn't have to do with the particular history or cultural traditions of a certain particular people, but it's universal. And that's what I meant earlier by these places in the landscape being, in a sense, all of our history. And I don't mean just in the Southwest, but Egypt or Africa, wherever you go and you see remnants or remains of the human history and human presence from the long distant past. It's us, because we all come out of a common historical tradition.
We're talking to writer and photographer David Grant Noble. His new book is called In the Places of the Spirits. So talk more about that. In what ways do you see links between the archaeological past around us here in the Southwest and the Native American present?
Well, I see a direct relationship. I mean, the ancestors of present-day Native Americans are the people who left these signs in the landscape. And that's why they're sacred to them. And as I tried to express earlier, I feel in a more general sense that they're sacred to all of us. And, you know, it's unfortunate that so many of these sites are on lands that are not protected from development especially, but also vandalism and looting.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how, you know, these things last for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and then in a few decades, many of them are destroyed.
Yeah, and they're our national patrimony, and our human patrimony, really.
Would you like to read a section from the book?
Yeah, sure, I'd be glad to. In 1990, I was hired, along with two Native American writers and two other photographers, to document in some artistic way the destruction of a big swath of the city of Phoenix in order to build an expressway across the city. And so there was this gigantic process of demolition going on, and also of building this expressway, which was all in the part of the Southwest that was lived in ancestrally by the Hohokam people, ancestors of the Pima and the Tohono O'odham people today. So anyway, we were supposed to make some sense out of this. And I will read a passage that relates to the photographs that I made during those 2 years. For more than a year, I traveled to Phoenix to roam around Pueblo Grande and its environs, photographing the multiple layers of culture in evidence as I watched the smoke-belching machines churn the earth while cars and trucks rumbled and honked in the nearby traffic-clogged streets and freight trains crawled toward downtown. Adding to the scene, passenger jets roared off the east end of Sky Harbor Airport. Planes, trains, cars, trucks, bulldozers, and road graders together produced a veritable cacophony that mixed with blowing dust and burning heat. The experience brought to mind scenes from post-cataclysm science fiction films. It was a photographer's dream and nightmare. In the middle of all the chaos lay open areas in which the foundations of old Phoenix industrial buildings twisted in the pain of demolition. Beneath them were the ruins of Pueblo Grande, which had lain dormant for 800 years. Among the adobe walls and floors, archaeologists kneeled, heads bent over their trowels and brushes. With methodical care, they brought into the light the trodden floors and stone hearths, the ceramic cooking pots and bone awls, the necklaces and the toys of children. Some mornings, I followed the railroad tracks eastward, resting for a while by a pair of shaggy palms to watch the jets as they rose into the sky and vanished in the rising sun. Summer afternoons, I photographed monsoon clouds as they built like pyramids over the distant hills and advanced over the desert toward the city, hopefully to bring us welcome shade and cooling rains. Later in the day, I again became spectator to the drama of the planes as they took off, now westward, and rose like pregnant dark birds to disappear into sunsets whose colors strained credibility. Did a more dynamic landscape exist on planet Earth? Everywhere I looked, things were happening, or had happened, or were about to happen.
David Grant Noble is writer and photographer, and his new book is called In the Places of the Spirits. It's published by the School for Advanced Research Press, and it has a wonderful foreword by N. Scott Momaday.
Yes, I was very fortunate that he has the generosity to write that foreword, and I'm grateful to him. I thank him for doing that. Thank you, Scott.
And David Grant Noble will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 o'clock on Thursday, and then again at Bookworks in Albuquerque on Sunday, the 25th of July at 5 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm delighted now to welcome Camille Flores. She is the public editor at the Santa Fe New Mexican, and she's author of the new book, Santa Fe Icons, 50 Symbols of the City Different. And she will be speaking today, this evening, at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe at 6 in the evening, along with photographer Jean Peach, who contributed to this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, this is a book about Santa Fe icons, 50 symbols of the city different, and there's everything from turquoise to the rail yard district to the oldest church, 10,000 Waves, the Virgin of Guadalupe, all old and new. How did you choose these 50?
Okay, well, first let me say that I couldn't choose an icon if I wanted to. The icons kind of choose you. I mean, they're icons because they're obvious. And so really the criteria, besides that there were to be no people named as icons, were simply that just in saying the name of the icon, it would automatically give you an image of Santa Fe.
Right.
And that would apply to people who have lived here for a long time or have lived here for generations, to people who are visiting the city, or to people who are newcomers.
And some of them are kind of sweet and amusing and not necessarily quite Santa Fe, like margaritas are in there. They're iconic,
although
margaritas don't really come from here.
That's true. They come from San Antonio, Texas, from what I understand. But I guess sitting on a patio in the sunshine with a margarita is just something that you do when you come to Santa Fe. So the ideas for particular icons came from three sources, from the publisher, Globe Pequot Press. They're from Connecticut, but the acquisitions editor lived here for several years. Gene Peach, the photographer, and myself. And we worked for about a week to just cull a longer list and figure out. And we were asked to bring suggestions to the table as well. So we eliminated some, we added some, and no, the margaritas wouldn't have been on my list.
Right.
But I don't drink tequila, so maybe that's why.
Well, there's in the introduction, there's a really nice metaphor about fallen fruit,
yes,
which I thought was beautiful. Tell us that.
I wrote the introduction after I had written everything else, and I'm so glad I did because I think it really encapsulates the way I came to feel about the icons and what they meant to the people of Santa Fe and the people who were looking at us from someplace else. And also I have to include another element, the fact that we are in the midst of our 400th anniversary.
Right.
And sometimes that has just been a jarring experience for me because I'm the kind of person who will talk about Santa Fe at the drop of a hat, love to talk about Santa Fe, to share. And the reaction I would get from some people was just downright mean-spirited. You know, we don't want to hear it. Your history isn't something we ought to celebrate. And so,
what kind of people were saying this?
A lot of people. There are a lot of people who just think that anything that happened within the Spanish colonial era was necessarily bad. And I'm not judging good or bad. I'm just saying it's what we are. And to look at that and to celebrate what we can is our duty and our love as well. And then, you know, you'd have other people who have all the answers, people. We know this better than you do. And finally, I just came to the conclusion that everybody has a right to feel these things about Santa Fe because it's everybody's town. So I also realized the evolution that's taken place here in our culture. So how do you just take all these differing viewpoints and make them work for people so that they'll want to come together and discuss things? And here I think my job as public editor really comes to the fore, because I always try to provide a comfortable place for people to exchange ideas. That's the job of a public editor. So maybe this book could do something like that as well.
And so tell us about the apricots.
So, it's really funny, but you know, I'm sure you know this, sometimes when you do your best writing, you don't really plan it, you just get a vision, or a visual. I'm not a visionary, but I did get this visual of apricot trees, which apricot trees are my favorite trees, and it's my favorite fruit. And the story that I tell in there about public fruit is a true story. I'm one of these people who really did just run past this tree with fruit all over the ground, thinking I couldn't take any of it because it wasn't mine. And then I heard the public fruit rule, which says that any fruit that falls on public property, like a sidewalk, belongs to everybody. And I sort of developed that into a metaphor for a cultural feast. And just thinking that if everybody would just be so kind as to approach it that way, they could bring to the table whatever they like, and they could take to the from the table everything they would like. And
I love that, because there is a lot of, and you know, with reason and with history, there's a lot about cultures being co-opted and cultures being stolen from each other. But the fact is, it's very hard to contain cultural ideas and expressions. People just take them up and use them.
Absolutely. You can apply that same idea to an artifact, too. So is Santa Fe going to become a museum? or Santa Fe an evolving culture? Of course it's an evolving culture. I had a wonderful college professor who used to talk about the folk all the time, saying that all the truth in the world came from the folk of a culture. And they couldn't be categorized as only existing between 1650 and 1750. I mean, they're still here. We are the folk now, and we're still developing and deciding and growing together apart. I mean, it's just a beautiful network, and it can be. So we need to work together on the next 400 years of Santa Fe.
The next 400 years. Think of it. We're talking to Camille Flores about the book Santa Fe Icons, 50 Symbols of the City Different. And it was fun to read it because, I mean, it's a very beautiful picture book, and the photographs are fantastic.
Jean did a beautiful job.
Yeah.
Jean and I are both professionals of long standing in Santa Fe. And I first met Jean way back when I worked for New Mexico Magazine, and he was the photographer often for a particular article or cover that we were doing. And so we sort of let each other have our space. We didn't tag around with each other to coordinate, so to make sure that his photographs fit my text or vice versa. So it was wonderful to see how this came together, because his vision of Santa Fe and mine differed in some places. But when you put the two together on the page, they made perfect sense. They were just great. They complemented each other. So that was fun to notice that. And people comment all the time about how beautiful the book is. And then I always say, yeah, but I hope you'll read it too.
Absolutely. Well, I was wondering, having read them, I mean, all these 50 icons, did you learn anything while you were doing it new and surprising to you?
Yes. And the first question that people usually ask me is, which was your favorite icon? But I love all the icons because they all hearken to some experience that I've had in Santa Fe, so they're wonderful things for me. But the ones that I learned the most on and that caused me to go off an entirely unanticipated learning experience, reading new books that I wouldn't have thought to pick up before, those are the ones. And the ones that I can think of right off the top of my head that have to do with Santa Fe around the age of statehood, when an entirely new population was here, and what they did and how they did it was very exciting. I didn't know anything about, other than where it was, the School of Advanced Research. I had been 1,000 times in the Museum of Fine Arts, sat in I don't know how many concerts in St. Francis Auditorium without actually understanding the significance of those buildings and what they represented to the cultural preservation that would go forth from that period. So there was new names to learn, and it just became exciting. I think I've ended up reading maybe 12 books, not on that particular era, but on icons that expanded my view of those. And that was after I wrote the book.
Right.
Yes. So if the book serves that purpose to people who read it, I will consider it a great success.
Is there anything that you felt like was left out now that it's published?
Ooh. I was talking to a gentleman yesterday, two people, and it's really funny, they both came up with icons that they were very upset about. Not upset, but they truly did wonder, they were sincere, why they weren't in the book. One of them was the Santa Fe River.
Ah.
And I said, not yet. If you
wait till there's
stood
water
on
in
the
it?
Plaza, that would be a first. That would be the first step. Well, this person is really involved with bringing back the river. I said, and that's well and good, but it's not an icon yet. The Rio Grande is going to overshadow that for many years to come, until, if I was in San Antonio, I would say the river immediately, because that's the thing that draws all the people together. And here, if it's revived and a culture builds around the river, that'll be the time when it should be an icon. The other one was, and this is a huge town favorite, and I really understand that, but it was the Santa Fe International Folk Art Market that we just had. And that was another thing that I said, possibly, but not yet.
Right.
Because it has an enormous following, but that doesn't really make it a Santa Fe icon. In
it hasn't been around long enough.
Hasn't been around long enough. And when it's in competition for icon status with things like the Spanish Colonial Art Market or for the Indian Market, there's just no contest.
Right. Or even Jackalope, which has been around for decades.
Which is in the book.
I know.
I know. So there will come a time when Santa Fe will put its unique stamp on the International Folk Art Market. Instead of the other way around. And then maybe, you know, it could be icon status.
Camille Flores is the author of the book Santa Fe Icons, 50 Symbols of the City Different, and she will be speaking along with photographer Jean Peach, who also worked on this book, tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 o'clock. She is also the public editor in the Santa Fe New Mexican. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. This is fun.
And thanks for this great book, which is a gift to Santa Feans and visitors alike.
That was a very nice thing to say. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Jake Barrow. He is program director of Cornerstone's Community Partnership, and Marcia Sullivan, who is the president of St. Michael's High School, which is partnering with Cornerstones in the San Miguel Preservation Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is a very highly visible Adobe and Santa Fe historical preservation, architectural preservation project. Tell us about it.
Well, as you know, the San Miguel Church is very old. That church dates to 1710, and there were several churches predating that.
It's the so-called oldest church, right?
It's the so-called oldest church. We know there was a church there by 1628, and probably some years before that, and maybe even started as early as 1609 or 1610. Two times in the 17th century the church came down, one time in a conflict between the ruling group and the Franciscans in a conflict that they had. And then later in the Pueblo Revolt, the church was destroyed, partly destroyed. In 1710, it was reconstructed, and that's more or less the church that we have today, although throughout the centuries there have been some modifications to the bell tower and the apse of the church, and some additions were added onto the church.
Right, as there are with any kind of building, but it's basically a continuity since 1710.
Exactly. And also, as you know, Santa Fe is an adobe city. Up until the 20th century, it was entirely adobe. Maybe a smattering of stone and wood buildings in there. And so this church is a part of that history, and it's part of the Analco National Landmark District, which is the little neighborhood which the church sits in. All of which were vernacular adobe homes, maintained in the traditional methods for hundreds of years. And in the 20th century, things began to change in Santa Fe. The city took on a new appearance. New materials began to be used in construction. Some of the traditional methods gave way to new methods, and that's kind of where we are today. And St. Michael's High School came to Cornerstones a few years ago to begin partnering on a preservation project for the church, and that's how we got started.
Now, has the church been used as a church all this time?
Yes, it has. It was up until the 1850s, it was part of the diocese and used as a parish church for that neighborhood. And maybe Marcy can speak to this. St. Michael's High School got started in the 1850s, and I might let her tell that story.
Thanks, Jake. In 1859, Bishop Lemie requested that the De La Salle Christian Brothers come to Santa Fe to start a school for boys. So it was around that time that the brothers came, established a high school for boys. It was called St. Michael's College, and that was their chapel. And they said their daily prayers, had religious studies there. And so that is when San Miguel Chapel became part of St. Michael's College, which is still our legal name, but evolved then into St. Michael's High School. And up until the 1960s, I think 1967, 68, it was both a residential program there and school for men. And then the new school was built on Siringo Road. And that's when the high school moved over to Siringo. But the church has remained part of the St. Michael's High School community since that time.
Do churches have to conform to building codes and all the kinds of regulations that everybody else does? In other words, when you have this ancient church that was built before the building codes were even invented, what happens?
Oh, absolutely. There's no... It's treated just as another building in Santa Fe as far as buildings codes are concerned. And so when we embarked on our project, we had several hoops to jump through in that regard. And since it's a part of the National Landmark District, the Analco District, it meant that we needed to consult with the State Historic Preservation Office, the New Mexico State Historic Preservation Officer, in terms of complying with what's called Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, which is basically, if you're intending to change those qualities of the building that have given it its legitimate right to be a part of that national register, then there could be some issues, and the state might not approve it. So it was very important for us to go to them and get approval, as well as going to the Historic Design Review Board of Santa Fe to get their approval for the work that we wanted to do. We're not really, early on, we decided with the school that we weren't really intending to change anything about the church per se in the architecture or the configuration. We did recognize that the stucco had failed and that's one of the primary problems that needed to be addressed. And so we are removing the stucco, and a decision was made to replace a traditional finish on the building, an earthen plaster. And so the appearance changes slightly, because instead of having a stucco, and there's a slightly different color to the surface. But essentially, we're not changing anything. And so we went through all that, as well as we had to go and get construction permits from the city. In addition, we consulted with the tribal we consulted with tribes who are affiliated with the city of Santa Fe in one way or another, which meant sending out letters to them about what we're going to do. And several tribes wrote back their interests and concern.
What were some of their interests and concerns?
Well, they didn't have any serious concerns. They just wanted to be informed. They wanted to know, you know, what tribes are interested in is if there are pre-Columbian burials on site. And that's one of the issues that we have. We have a drainage project. We have to excavate in the churchyard. It's very likely that we'll encounter human remains. So that had to be addressed very carefully, not only with the diocese, but the tribes.
Has that happened yet? Has anything been found?
Well, you know, the archaeologists are working, but it really is not... we won't know until the conclusion of that excavation as to what's there. That they also have to go through quite an extensive process to do that. And basically, through that process, the archaeologists are working inside a contained area, and it's totally off limits to the public or anybody that's not involved in the project, because should they encounter human remains, they have to be handled very carefully and in a very in a way that's respectful to the descendants and the remains themselves. And so that process is underway, and we really won't know until the conclusion of the project what the disposition of that is.
When you say that it's there's a good chance that there are human remains there, why is that? I mean, were churches built usually like this one on traditional burial sites?
Well, not only that, I mean, Santa Fe is a site that was inhabited by Native Americans prior to the Spanish coming. And on a site like this, it's right up over the river on a little rise, and there have been excavations there prior that indicated the presence of Native American structures. So... It's not unlikely that would be found. And prior to doing the project, we conducted a ground-penetrating radar over the terrain of the churchyard to see if we could what we would find. And sure enough, I mean, the ground-penetrating radar did indicate burials in the churchyard. Fortunately, the area in which we're excavating did not indicate coffins or anything like that. So it's pretty complex. And in a situation like this, it's hundreds and hundreds of years of church. Certainly all the churches use the area around the church and sometimes inside the church for burials. That's just the tradition. So in the time period in which it was a church, there's likely to be many, many burials there. And also the other thing that happened is over the centuries, these things get... The ground gets disturbed a lot. There was previous drains were there. Digging happens. And the coffins are not well... There's not a map of where all these coffins are, these burials. And so sometimes burials are done with coffins. Sometimes they're done in a primitive fashion. It's not unlikely that there's going to be portions of human bodies, bones that could be found. And this has to be dealt with very carefully.
Right.
So we just don't know. And it all just has to be done by a professional archaeologist, and they're out there working.
So what is the process like of actually doing this renovation? You're out there every day in the hot sun, taking stuff down, putting stuff up. I mean, what's it actually like?
Well, what happened in this case was a couple of years ago when St. Mike's came to Cornerstones, the first step was to do an assessment of the building. And we were able to get a grant for that, and a very thorough assessment was done to sort of find out what are the conditions, where are the problem areas, what has to be addressed here. And it was in the course of that we found that there were some major drainage problems, that some of the walls were retaining moisture, probably as a result of this, that the stucco was at the end of its life. That stucco was basically put on in 1955, so it's had cracks all over, been repaired many times. And there were some probable problems with some roof connections, the way some of the roofs were built in the late 19th century. Likely there was some rot in the wood, you know. So the process, that was all determined, and then we had to develop a work plan. And then seeking funding to do the project was a big part of the preliminary process, and we were successful in getting 4 grants to date. So that got the project underway. And, of course, we were working with St. Mike's very closely in the planning process as we got this going. And then, in addition, we decided to try to partner with some other groups. We set up a partnership with YouthWorks in Santa Fe to provide some youth training opportunities and the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation for the state to see about bringing at-risk youth or youth that, in this case, many of these youth are working on their GEDs. You know, they're not kids that can typically sit in a classroom. So we thought, you know, we're doing some hard Adobe-type work. Get those youth out there to give them an experience and an opportunity. And then we also embarked on a active volunteer program to put the word out for anyone in the community who wanted to come and volunteer.
And you're still looking for people.
We're still looking for people. And one of the ideas that we have about this is that this church, it's not just a simple project of preserving a church for the church, for St. Mike's. I mean, it's a larger goal of community and the role that St. Mike's has had, the history of Santa Fe. And
well, how will the San Miguel Church, or chapel, as it's, I guess it's called, be used when this whole renovation is over?
Well, it's still being used. The great thing about the way Jake and Cornerstones has approached this is to make sure that it's still open every day for visiting tourists, for parishioners who like to come. There are still 2 masses each Sunday, a Latin mass at 2 and an English mass at 5. So despite the fact that it's getting a pretty major facelift, it's open every day. In terms of St. Mike's High School, one of the great things about San Miguel Church is it is really a physical manifestation of what the school is going through. Jake said something earlier in the interview that I really liked. He said the adobe construction uses traditional materials, but years later we've moved to more contemporary methods. That's the same thing with our school. And I just find it interesting that there's this parallel trajectory between what the church is going through, the church where St. Michael's High School was founded, and what the school today is going through. So it's a really important part of our history, but it's a really important part of our future, and getting our kids involved, having them understand what this means in the history of the school. We hope that over the next three summers, which this project will take the next three summers to complete, we will build on the participation of our teachers and the history department and the students who may be interested in this kind of community service.
Now, is St. Michael's High School a religious school with religious education, and people are expected to be practicing Catholics?
It is a Catholic school based on the LaSallian tradition of education. The LaSallian Christian Brothers are a teaching order, and they are sanctioned by the Catholic Church here. We are in partnership with the Archdiocese. Our students are about 70% Catholic. We have non-Catholics who attend St. Michael's as well. But we are a religious school that opens with prayer every day. We have Mass at least once a month. We celebrate all of the Catholic feast days and holidays, etc. But you don't have to be Catholic to go to St. Michael's.
Now, Jake Barrow, tell us the question which you deftly avoided, what it's like to be out in the hot sun every day doing this adobe.
I wasn't avoiding it. I just wanted to give the background for it. I think that brings to mind about the volunteers that come to work with us, because it's actually sometimes it's pretty hard work. We're crushing up clay that's like rocks. We're sifting it through a screen. We're doing a mixer. We're pushing wheelbarrows that are heavy. We're making adobes. They weigh 30 pounds plus a piece. We're taking stucco off the building and piece by piece taking it down off the scaffold, piling it up, shoveling it into a trailer, taking it to the dump. I mean, there's a lot of this pretty hard work, and what's interesting is that the youth and the volunteers that have come out have really enjoyed it, and it's hot out there. We make sure we have plenty of water and we take breaks when we need them, but it's been thus far, it's been really interesting to see. We've had a very diverse group of volunteers, from a philosophy professor down to people who are on parole and putting in their community service, to people who are trying to get their GED, to Harvard graduate students, and all and Santa Fe local people who just are interested to come out. St. Mike's kids, the football team was out there three times in succession. And so, you mix all these people up and you think, how's this going to work? I mean, these people can't communicate. But actually, it's surprising how well it works. It's really surprising to me. And then the other part of that is that every day we get a lot of visitors. And sometimes they're tourists, and sometimes they're local people who are walking up to who graduated from the school in 1938 or 1940 or 1960 or something, and they want to find out what's happening. And so we talk to them. Cornerstones is about heritage and community. And when you think about historic preservation, a lot of times people think that, you're just going to restore the building back to the way it was or something like that, and where after the work is done, you take a picture and it's all over with. But our point of view is that the validity of historic preservation really is about the people who are using the building. It's not just about the building. And in fact, we believe for historic preservation to be valid, you can't have one without the other. And so,
Jake Barrow is Program Director of Cornerstones Community Partnership. Marcia Sullivan is President of St. Michael's High School. We've been talking about the San Miguel Chapel Preservation Project. If people want to call and volunteer, how can they do so? How can they reach Cornerstones?
Well, that's great. We're really open to that. And they call our office at 982-9521. Right here in Santa Fe, and speak to Gene Boley, who keeps a kind of a list for us, and we're tracking that, because if we were to just say, just show up, we one day we might have 75 people or something, and it would be totally unmanageable, and I'd hate somebody to come out. So far, we haven't turned anybody away. But we do try to steer them to a day. And some days are more appropriate than other days because sometimes we're doing things where we need a lot of help, and sometimes we're it's very specific.
And Cornerstones can also be found on the web at cstones.org. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.